AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 55 for Thursday, May 13th, 2010, Car Wreck. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thursday nights, we're here. We're glad that you're joining us. And as I always start out the show saying, I'm glad that the auto extremist himself is here in the house with us again tonight.
John, I'm glad to be here once again for the 78th month in a row.
And David Welch as well from Bloomberg Business Week, or I should say Business Week powered by Bloomberg.
I guess you could say that. Always good to be here, John.
Yeah, good having you here. So, where do we start? I mean, there was a lot of things. Peter, you started writing about Cadillac and their new tag.
Another quiet week. Yeah, Cadillac came out with a new campaign called The Mark of Leadership from their new agency in New York. And I sort of probably gave the readers more historical background than they had patience for, but I think it was within context because Cadillac just isn't another car company. And I thought that after all of what's gone on, the changing of agencies and everything, it was disappointing what they came up with. It's just not what they need to do. Mm-hmm. Cadillac needs to, and like I said, put their stake in the ground and go for it. And if it means, you know, spending more money and breaking them off more from the GM umbrella, they need to do what they need to do. I mean, they're certainly capable of it. I mean, you know, you've been around the halls. You guys have been around the halls of GM. They're capable of doing whatever they want to do. It's that want to, you know, that I need to see in a, I don't know, the campaign.
You don't see it.
Campaign's lackluster. It's just like, yeah, whatever, you know.
So, I mean, their sales haven't been doing all that great. The SRX has been red hot, but everything else, certain models of the Escalade are doing well, but even the CTS is slowing down fast.
Yeah, well, they need to crank it up. You know, it's, you know, GM contracted, and yet they're still having the same problem they did. You know, when they're patting Buick on the head and saying, nice Buick, spend money on Buick. You know, Chevrolet, you know, languishes, and then they spend money on Chevrolet. It's just like, oh, man, Cadillac, you know, and it's just they're not firing on all cylinders yet. Certainly not in the marketing department.
Right.
That's for sure.
Well, I mean, they've had a lot of turnover, and now they've got somebody new in there.
Yeah.
Joel Iwanyk, who's supposed to turn it around, and we'll see. But, you know, I'm with you. I mean, the mark of leadership is it's a pretty limp tagline. It doesn't do anything for me. And, you know, you talk about the CTS has been struggling for a while, which is a shame because it's a terrific
car. In fact, I just had the V-Series last week for test driving.
That thing is awesome.
I still think a big part of their problem at Cadillac is, I mean, you have an SRX that's a really good vehicle and selling well. CTS is really good. But there's nothing else in the showroom that really lights anybody up. You go to an Audi, BMW, or Mercedes, or Lexus showroom, and you got, you know, 8-10 models or more.
And Mercedes, well, somewhere on the way, we know. So Cadillac does have stuff coming.
Yeah, you have an XTS, but that's, what, next year?
Well, you also got the new smaller, that whole lineup of smaller.
The ATS, yeah, but that's like 2012 as a 13 model.
No, you're right. It is a ways.
The other thing bothers me.
We're in early 2010 here, the first half. I mean, it's too far away. I mean, you know, part of what draws people to buy a vehicle is the brand has momentum behind it, and there's a lot of other cool stuff in the showroom and out on the road. Now, you know, in a way, you have to have patience here. I mean, one thing we forget about GM is we impatiently, like Big Ed, look for results. It's only been 9-10 months since they got out of bankruptcy. And, you know, product plans and turnarounds in this business and brand building certainly doesn't happen overnight. It takes quite a while. But, you know, Cadillac is the real shame of Cadillac to me in the Cadillac story is that this is a brand that had momentum a few years ago. And in terms of they took the foot off the pedal 2004, 2005.
Well, the bankruptcy thing really did a lot more damage than people realize, I think, in terms of momentum of these brands. I mean,
they had some other products on the drawing board 2004, 2005, and because of the financial troubles, you know, those cars were backburnered, and that's what's hurting them now. I mean, they've got good CTS and a great new SRX, but you know, there's not enough else in the other stuff in the showroom to really get draw people into the brand and get it the kind of hype and attention it needs to amp up. So it's going to take time. It's unfortunate.
And the other thing is the creative approach they did, where Mark of Leadership was shockingly similar to a Jaguar campaign of just a couple years ago. And guess what? The writer, art director team that worked on that Jaguar campaign also did Cadillac. Hmm. So if you go to YouTube and look at the two, it's just like, oh, okay.
I mean, the team that did the Jaguar campaign did the new Cadillac campaign?
Yeah. So when you see the finished executions of the Jaguar and the new Mark of Leadership, it's frighteningly similar. So, I mean, you know, you're just shooting yourself in the head when you do stuff like that. So,
well, one thing that you brought out in your column I liked was reviving this ad that I don't know how far back it goes.
Penalty of Leadership.
The Penalty of Leadership.
1915.
So there's something that really, there's a statement, not the Mark of Leadership, the Penalty of Leadership. That's something that they should, why not just revive that?
Yeah, we have a link to it in the column now. We didn't at first, but it's just magnificent, brilliant copywriting. So, you know, it pretty much created the art form, as far as I'm concerned, for, you know, great print advertising. And then, you know, then Cadillac had the standard of the world because Leland was all about precision machining and you know, interchangeable parts that were flawless. And, you know, Cadillac had it going on. And my whole point, and, you know, boy, I got blasted by a lot of, Cadillac will never get there. You have to aspire to do something. If you just sit there and say, well, we're never going to get there, so we're not even about it, you know, that's bullshit. You have to, you know, GM has to make up their minds that we are going to go for it. Mm-hmm. We're going to shoot for that. We may not reach it, but we're going to do everything in our power to get there. And then I think in the meantime, or, you know, on the way to that, they'll come up with some pretty good cars. And but they got to, you know, it's one of the great brands. You know, where's the great image advertising? It's just not there.
It's not. Hey, other news, David, this week, Chrysler earnings. What'd you make of them posting at least an operating profit and a net loss that was so small I'd almost call it a profit?
Well, you know, I think the strategy they have appears to be working. They've cut and cut. You know, one thing that I wanted to get to the bottom of, and I haven't yet, is that, you know, they show they're on pace for $2.7 billion in CapEx this year. In their plan in November, they said they were going to be at $4.1 billion. Now, that included engineering and R&D, but I want to know if they cut their, you know, because even a half a billion dollar swing where they are is a big difference. But, you know,
so what you're saying, they're not spending as much on capital expenditures,
they might
plant
not
equipment
be.
And tooling?
To be honest with you, I don't have the exact, you know, breakdown. I mean, the $4.1 billion they gave us last fall was engineering, R&D, and CapEx, and they gave us a CapEx number the other day. So, you know, it all depends on whether or not they're counting that in there. And if they cut back, you know, product spending in order to make those, you know, the numbers look pretty good and to keep things afloat, well, then you're eating the seed corn. I don't know if that's what they're doing, but it's something to look into. But, I think they are, you know, they've cut costs. Their break-even is really low. Their sales aren't horrible. I mean, they are giving them away basically with some aggressive fleet sales and bigger discounts. They got 0% now, but you know they didn't have that in the first quarter. Yeah, it shows that I think they're treading water a bit, but it's better than we all thought they were going to do.
Right, and don't forget too though, in the sales numbers, you can't forget Canada, Mexico, and international sales too. And they're doing pretty well in Canada these days, albeit a small market, but. You know,
what did they tell us we
focus on what their U.S. sales are. All I'm saying is there's a little bit more to it than that.
Well, they must have also taken some more out of the bottom or out of the cost to get to a lower break-even point, because back in January, Sergio Marchionne told us that they needed to sell 1.1 million in the U.S. and I think 1.4, 1.5 internationally a year. You know, that was the break-even and start to show some black ink point to the company. And they're not on pace for that. So they must have cut even more out. And, you know, so they're either cutting places where they aren't, or they found some more. And Sergio's pretty good at that stuff.
Well, remember, one of the things that they have been able to do is cut back on their incentives, because they're getting something like at least $2,000 more revenue per vehicle than they were just a few months ago.
They're doing a better job. They got a lot of fleet, though, still. They got some heavy fleet sales.
Well, I know, but I keep saying, why does anybody expect them to increase their retail? They haven't introduced a new product in 2 years. How could you increase your retail?
You know, they're not doing a great job at retail, and that's where you make the big bucks. So, you know, they've got to have, you know, really cut. And, hey, you know, if they can hang on, they got a new Grand Cherokee coming, and then the 300. You know, the good thing about Chrysler always has been that as a smaller company with fewer products in the line, one or two hits for them has been able to make a pretty dramatic difference to the bottom line. You know, when they launched the 300 initially a few years ago, and Dieter was running the company, he said, you know, this was a car that brought in some real money in terms of profitability, and they didn't have to rely just on Ram and minivan and like Grand Cherokee to carry the water. They had a fourth car to do it. And, you know, we've seen it before with the minivan. We've seen it with PT Cruiser. We saw it with the Ram in the mid-90s where, you know, one big vehicle brought in a lot of money for them. Whereas, you know, even now GM, even though they pared the brand list and the product line down, you know, they still have over 30 nameplates, and having one hit car doesn't really make a massive difference for them. But Chrysler's small enough where a couple good vehicles could do it.
They need that Grand Cherokee to be a hit.
They do.
It's got to be a big hit.
Hey, Peter, what do you make of the UAW coming out in the last day and saying, hey, if you guys are getting better, we want everything back again?
You know, I sort of give up with that. I mean, I think it was the wrong thing to say at the wrong time, and I predict this King guy is going to be a snake in the grass for you watch. If we see, like you've said and we've all said, these boom times, these boom profits, then King's going to be right there with his hand out saying, okay, where's our money? It's just the wrong message to send. These companies aren't out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, he really needed to say that right at this point in time? I think it was ridiculous, really.
You know, you could have a public relations lesson from the UAW on exactly the wrong things to say at the worst possible time, because they have a habit of shooting their mouths off like this right when all of America is paying a lot of attention to Detroit. And, you know, to a lot of Americans, they look at these companies as one, or Detroit as one town, one industry that all operates the same way. And we know it's not exactly like that. But GM has a lot of attention on it now over the big ads and Government Motors, and did they really pay all the money back or not? And a lot of people are up in arms about that. It turns out it's a minority, because they've done pretty well in some surveys in terms of image in the past couple of weeks. But here you have, you know, that's fresh on the mind, and you have people, Republicans in Congress, criticizing GM and focusing on this, and then the union guy comes out and says, to what a lot of Americans will sound like, we haven't learned a thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a crazy statement to make. If he wants to think that, and he wants to tell them that at the bargaining table behind closed doors, because he's got to talk tough at the table, I get it. Why would you say that in a public forum where the media's there and it's going to be all over the place? Yeah. America doesn't really care for the UAW. A lot of people blame the UAW for a pretty good portion of what's gone wrong with this industry here. Rightly or wrongly. I mean, the UAW is not all to blame, for sure. There's been some bad management, bad cars.
It had a lot of help in it.
Yes.
I mean, there was a lot of bad habits and a lot of exorbitant costs that simply made the Detroit 3 non-competitive, just from a labor cost standpoint.
I don't even get what King is doing. Well, you know, at a situation like right now, where the companies are starting to get traction, even if he wants to posture for his own guys to say that I'm a tough negotiator who's going to win something back for you. Why do you want to do that at this moment? Because there's no bargaining to be done just yet. The companies aren't in a condition to give anything back right now still. The economy and the car market aren't. What does he get out of that?
It's just
he's going to set up expectations among his own guys.
It's just a boneheaded move.
Yeah.
you're right, setting up expectations, and it's just like, and what you said earlier is, to the outside of this industry, people outside of this business hears that, and they'll just say, that's the same old stuff going on there. What's going on?
People accuse the Detroit Press Corps and the car companies of being insular. UAW really is. And they've got a worse image for that than anybody, and this just, you know, really hammers that with a, you know, on granite with a chisel.
Peter, I want to get your reaction to a soundbite that we have. Earlier this week, my producer, Chip Drake, was out with BMW in Philadelphia, of all places, for the new 5 Series and a couple of other products that they had. But, you know, we've talked on the show about the new Joy advertising campaign that BMW has got, and that's what the soundbite is about, is Jack Pitney, the head of marketing for BMW North America?
I don't know. The BMW brand, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He was with Mini.
Was with Mini, right.
And then launched they moved that. Him over to BMW.
Right. So anyway, Chip asked him, are you getting rid of the greatest tagline in advertising, the ultimate driving machine, and just going with Joy? But Ben, let's bring up that soundbite. I want to get Peter's reaction to this.
No, actually, we have the same emphasis on the ultimate driving machine in today's commercials that we had 3-4 years ago. The only difference is we have introduced a new Joy theme, which is a bit startling to some people, because for a Germanic company to be talking about Joy, it seems at times incongruous. But we actually think it's exactly what we're all about, and we think there's never been a better time for a hopeful, optimistic message like Joy.
So what do you make of that? Do you buy what he's saying, that they're keeping the ultimate driving machine on the same plane?
Not at all. I mean, not at all. I mean, I just opened a magazine today. I forget what it was. And there were like 2 or 3 print ads, not sequentially, but spaced out in a magazine. And the biggest word you see is Joy. And over in the right-hand corner, if you squint, you see ultimate driving machine. So, no, they're not placing the same emphasis on ultimate driving machine. That's a crock. I mean, they have gone off the reservation here. This is the German saying, well, you know, it works over here. You guys need to do it over there. And
is it the Germans or is it Jack Pitney?
No, it's
this
coming.
This is out of Munich.
It's coming from Germany, and you know.
In fact, they're using the same tagline worldwide, and in fact, the U.S. is about the last place where they've started using it.
And well, Jack signed up for the deal, so he's going to sit there and he's going to, you know, come out swinging. I mean, but I'm not buying it, you know. And I think you commented, John, before. It's just diluting. They're trying to make it more approachable. They're trying, which is the last thing they need to do. I mean, the American consumer buys into the ultimate driving machine, and you know, I just think it's wrongheaded for this market.
They want to make it more approachable. Is that because they want sales volume, basically?
Exactly. That's what I'm reading into it.
Yeah, that's right. What I read. And you know, Watts gave me a great line. A month or so ago, he was talking about Cadillac versus Lincoln, you know, racing, trying to win the sales race, even using some sleazy tactics to do it in the late 90s. And he said, so here you have 2 luxury brands in a race to be the least exclusive luxury brand.
Yeah, and, you know, we were corrected. We said it was 25 years. It's been 35 years with Ultimate Drive Machine. You know, it's so, you know, sounding like a broken record, but it's so difficult to get these themes ingrained in the consumers' minds. It's so difficult. And they've done a wonderful job on it. Their products haven't always lived up to it, especially the more recent stuff. That 5GT is just a nightmare, but I know David likes it.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. It's sweet.
I like the car.
Yeah. But
the interior is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
You have to admit that.
Yeah. But, I mean, I just think, why? Why? It's so difficult. And here they go and throwing Joy. And, of course, Jack's going to say, oh, yeah, it's all good. And then, you know, he also said, which we didn't play, that the dealers are all signed up. And I know for a fact that's not true. You know, the dealers are just saying, what are you guys, nuts? I mean, come on. So
if I were a BMW dealer, I'd buy a massive billboard and have my own Ultimate Driving Machine ad and huge letters right next
to it. But look at the ads. Go ahead and look at the print ads or look in the TV. It's joy, joy, and then over here, oh, yeah, we're still the Ultimate Driving Machine. And the ultimate insult is they've got their BMW M3 GT cars in the ALMS, very competitive, Ray Hall Letterman Racing, with big joy on the side of it. And these are your ultimate drive machines, and you've got joy plasma. It's just, God, give it, really, stop.
Yeah, well, I think I mentioned before, they should paint those race cars pink and put butterflies on them. That would fit with the joy.
Yeah, rainbows, little bunny rabbits. It's all good.
What's the Shakespeare line? What men dare do, what men may do, what men daily do without knowing what they're doing. It's a great line. I love it.
It's a great line, and that's a great
there
segue to bring our guest on.
Joy is on the race car.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm not kidding you. It's all over the race car.
But let's bring our guest on for today's show. Mark, come on in, please. We've got Mark Ragsdale, the author of the book Car Wreck, a dealer, director, and let me read this from the, sit down and put a mic on, director of the Massachusetts State Automobile Dealers Association, chairman of a National Dealer 20 group, member of the Kia National Dealer Council, and you've had a number of dealerships yourself, right?
9 rooftops, counting 3 motorcycle stores.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
and you come from a dealership family, right?
My dad moved from Missouri in the mid-60s and by 72 had a Chevrolet dealership in a rural community.
Is that where the cowboy hat comes from? You don't see a lot of those in the
Yeah, way. Well, in the back of the book, there's an appendix that kind of excuses that. And my wife doesn't like the cowboy hat. But
I like the hat. I'm just saying, I don't see a lot of them in New England.
That's true.
I lived in Texas for 5 years, so
marketing
I got one
my
myself.
Dealership, you know, being the cowboy on TV was probably more distinguishing than having a Red Sox cap on.
Okay.
You know, if I had a dealership in Austin, Texas,
you'd wear a Red Sox
Peter
hat
first, but I'd probably put on a Red Sox cap.
You'd put on a Yankees hat.
Town, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Really
No. And go Celtics tonight. They need this win.
Hey, one thing, I found your book really interesting, too, by the way, because I've read zillions of books about the automotive industry. I don't think I've ever read one that analyzes it from a dealer's point of view. And one of the things that jumped out of the book at me is one of the things that you point out is none of the car companies has got a dealer on the board of directors. In fact, to my knowledge, no dealer has ever sat on the board of directors. And explain why you think that would make a difference for the car companies.
Well, where is the industry going without its dealers? That's the big question that these executives don't really want to answer. I mean, well, we can save $2 billion by cutting out 2,300 of them. Right? We can fire 789 of them, and 60% of our production, in the case of Chrysler, is going to go to fleet and rental car companies. You go nowhere without the retailer. And so one would think that since you build cars, you finance cars, and we as dealers sell cars, that we may have some type of a stake at the table for everybody's benefit, not just for the dealer's benefit, for the consumer's benefit.
There might be a problem with putting a dealer on the board, though, and it's sort of a conflict of interest kind of thing, because most of you guys own multiple franchises. So you have somebody, say, in the General Motors board who's looking at things going out a number of years, company strategy, and you're also working with, say, Toyota or Ford or something like that. I think it's, in concept, it's a good idea, and they've never had it. I mean, they've had labor on the board. Doug Frazier, former UAW president, was on the board of Chrysler in the 90s. But, you know, is that one reason maybe why they don't do it, or is it, you know, they just don't want you guys around?
Well, you know, but I don't know from an SEC standpoint. I don't know what they're, well, there's been some allegations of what they look at, right, during the day, the SEC lately. But mm-hmm. From an SEC standpoint, I don't know whether that's unachievable, but the dealers are on dealer councils. They have multiple franchises, and they go into dealer councils, and they sign non-disclosure agreements. I've signed them.
I don't know the answer either. I'm just teeing up the question, but it's...
Well, even an ex-dealer. How about somebody that's never been in manufacturing but had an illustrious and glorious career in retailing? You know, take that guy. I'll do it.
Sure.
I'd do it. I'd sit on a board. I'd probably get thrown out like Ross Perot the next day. I'd take a swing at it.
I think, David, you raise a really good point, but there's got to be some GM-exclusive dealers who would fit the bill for what you would think would be ideal on the board.
There you go. Go with a GM
exclusive. There's probably a way to do it.
Then he has to agree not to buy anything else while he's...
Sure.
Well, he's there, I guess.
Well, you know, you don't have to appoint him for life, Ethan. Yep. You know, you could rotate these dealers in and out every 5 years or whatever.
I just bring it up because A.G. Laffey was on, you know, he's with Procter & Gamble, and he was on GM's board a few years ago, and he had to leave because I think he took a board position with, I think, GE, and GE Capital competes with GMAC. So, you know, you get in some issues like that. So, you know, I just tee it up as, you know, kind of a, you know, an SEC question. But... your point stands. I mean, there is no retail presence on these boards. I mean, you don't even see necessarily executives at from any kind of retailer on the current boards, I don't think. I mean, Neville Isdell on GM's board is probably the closest. He ran Coke, not a retailer, but good marketing company anyway.
I don't think they want to hear it. I mean, the relationship, dealers often judge my book by its cover, meaning they go, oh, well, this guy is a rat. All right, this guy's going to ruin my customer base. I'm not going to be able to make any money if it, that's not what this book is. It's a pro dealer book, actually. What I tell consumers is there's not enough money in it for you to waste 90% of your energy figuring out how to negotiate a better price when 90% of the money is lost elsewhere in the transaction. We finance the cars wrong. Rebates and fleet sales destroy the future value of cars while customers are making payments on them. And the automakers aren't the only ones. You know, the banks are in on it with some funky, I have a chapter, I was talking to John earlier, they have funky interest calculation methods. The industry as a whole does a lot of things wrong, and the dealers are put out in front of that, almost as human shields. And, you know, when the consumer pays too much and the dealer doesn't make enough, and everybody else gets bailed out when something goes wrong, there's something fundamentally wrong with the business, which is why I wrote the book. They can't get too close to their dealers because then they lose that relationship. They love when something comes out that says, you know, the car dealers are nasty or they're going to rip you off. I mean, it just puts a big facade out in front of a, you know, which is a troubled industry right now. And I don't think they want them in the room telling the truth.
Yeah, well, I think if you had somebody on the board, you'd start to get the truth and probably start making changes. One of the other things that came out in the book that I found fascinating was, as you described, the terrible relationship between the factory and the dealer. And I'm sure there's problems at most car companies, but General Motors in particular. And you've had a number of GM stores. And what I'm wondering is, as everybody tries to analyze why GM sales aren't moving, seems to me the product's pretty good these days. Certainly everything that Bob Lutz had come out of that company in the last 4 years, I would describe as world-class competitive. But it's not selling all that great. And, you know, the whole focus has been on sales and marketing. And I'm wondering if the real underlying cause of this is a bad relationship between GM and its dealers.
Well, it's terrible. As I talk to dealers, it's always semicolon, but don't attribute this to me because... I don't want to be an ex-GM dealer. They don't want to face the retribution from the automaker because
where's
they're
the
very vindictive.
Where's the angst come from? I mean, what are some of the things that really poison the relationship between GM and the dealers that you've seen?
GM and product. You know, you're selling two a month, but you earned 40, you know? You sold 40 and earned two. Because of the production system didn't line up. You know, you mentioned the UAW earlier. You had jobs banks clauses that forced production of product, whether the market needed them or not. When they couldn't get dealers to take more cars, they just start selling them to rental car companies. So there's jamming of product. There are marketing programs that get jammed down dealers' throats, dealer marketing groups, local marketing groups, regional marketing groups, that from a pure business perspective, we could do the math on the back of a napkin, and it doesn't make any sense. I opted out of one of those because in my state, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, it was optional, and the automaker was not to coerce in any way its dealers. Well, I soon found that the factory had told the dealers in my market not to swap Chevrolets with me. So, and I cite that in the book, it's apparently to them, it's far better to punish you for not going and towing the party line than it is to deliver a car to a customer. If you don't take product and you don't sign up for the marketing programs that are optional, that really aren't optional, and you don't update your showroom because it doesn't make any investment sense to do that, you're not going to get your money back out of the facility. They send audit teams in. And it's, I guess it's just like the IRS. Any, you know, I that's not dotted or T that's crossed incorrectly, whether it's from warranty repair reimbursement or rebates that we've fronted customers, they come in and take it all back and decapitalize dealerships. And that takes its toll. And then they skipped out on the NADA this year, right? The first time in 100 years, they said it was cost savings. How do you take your national sales force and tell them that they're so unimportant? I mean, the survivors, the people that hung in there when nobody knew what was going to happen next. Am I going to get terminated next? Am I going to get wound down or whatever the story was? And you're at the beginning of the sales season, and they don't even show up to talk to those guys to give them any kind of encouragement. I mean, if we ever ran our stores that way, we wouldn't have one sales consultant working for us. And this has been going on for decades and decades. My father was a Chevrolet dealer before me. And that creates a lot of alienation, and it does affect sales.
You've had other stores, too. Is it different with different manufacturers? I mean, is GM worse than the others or pretty much like the rest of them?
GM... you know, was the worst. I had an extremely large Honda store that I opened. It was interesting. I found them to have the same attitude that GM started with when they were on top decades ago. So Honda's attitude isn't particularly positive towards its dealers, but the dealers at that time were making a lot of money with Honda, so, you know, there's less to complain about. You know, they go to a brand meeting at NADA and the dealers want to talk about racing or something like that. They don't really talk about, you know, vocalize the issues. The nicest people are really the people at Kia Motors America. I've always found them to be the most respectful. Certainly when Peter Butterfield ran the company, and I sat on different boards during Peter's tenure, he wrote the foreword to my book. He always entertained the dealers' ideas because he knew that they were the gatekeepers to sales. Of course, he had to turn around, like you said, with the Germans, a lot of stuff comes from overseas, so he had to turn around and sell it back to the Koreans, what we wanted to do. But yeah, GM was by far the worst in my experience.
Another thing that comes out of your book is you think that leasing's the best way to go. Actually, what you say is if you can pay cash, if you can afford to pay cash for a car, that's the best way. But other than that, you recommend leasing. Why leasing over buying, financing a car to buy it?
I actually don't advocate paying cash for a new car, even if you can.
Oh, okay.
I advocate buying a used car. If you can pay cash, that's great. I don't like that the consumer, at the end of the day, is the one that's on the hook for all this massive depreciation. It's unpredictable. You don't know when they're going to build too many of this and that and sell them to fleet and rental companies. You don't know when they're going to put massive rebates on the next round of new ones. And that deflation trickles down to the rest of the market that everybody's driving. And if it isn't one of those things going on, it's the unpredictability of safety concerns and negative media coverage. If you look at what happened to Toyota, you know, really strong brand, great quality, great confidence. And they still lost between 7 and 12% at the auction once the poop hit the fan. And the consumers making payments on their cars every month, they don't see it until they go in to try and trade that car and find out that they owe more on it than what it's worth. That's why I like leasing. At least you can get off the bus every 3 years debt-free. Turn over the keys and figure out what you want to do next.
But is that for most consumers? I mean, what about people who are more disciplined as they go about it and don't come in to buy a new car still owing money on the old one?
Well, they still fight the depreciation issue. So if you make 6 long years of payments, 72 months, 6 long years of payments, and the car has been hit and depreciated because the manufacturer decided to sell 30,000 of them to rental fleets, and they come back the same year with 12,000 or 15,000 miles on them at 50 or 60% off of MSRP, what's your six-year-old car with 110,000 miles going to be worth? Not very much. So it's really unavoidable. In fact, the biggest issue with automakers right now is they need to get control of their residual values, because the business is not asset-based lending. It's nothing about that. It's about covering up sins with rebates. It's about floor planning too much on a car that's upside down, because by the time you take the hold back out and by the time you take the optional dealer marketing group fees, which are about $600 a car, and the bank hawks that so the dealer has them on the lot, well, if a dealer tips upside down, what happens? Those cars are worth a minimum of $1,500 less a piece. And with everything that's going on in the economy right now, that's what I see coming next. I see a bank's reluctance to loan money on cars, whether they're at the dealer's lot or whether it's you or me trying to buy one, and because there's no asset basis to the loan.
So, sounds pretty grim, but one thing that I see happening in the industry right now, at least coming out of Detroit, is the push model's gone. You know, they no longer have to build cars just to try to support the jobs bank and everything else. The legacy costs are gone, and I see them really keeping, as they call it, a disciplined approach between production and sales. And I got to believe residuals will be going up.
They may come up a little bit. The Malibu came up while the Camry went down during the first quarter. So the residual value for Malibu went up. But at the same time, when you looked at the two automakers, you could have a Camry for $1,600 out of pocket and $199 a month, or a Malibu for $3,700 out of pocket and $199 a month. I don't, you know, if the cars were dead nuts even in quality, what would make the consumer's attitude, you know, towards General Motors to pay $2,000 more for that car? That $2,000 was all about the depreciation, the excess depreciation that Malibu is going to experience. And it's going to experience that not because it's not a great car, not because it doesn't have great quality, but because they sell thousands of them to rent-a-car companies. And even though they're, you know, more careful and they're able to get out of building extra cars because they don't have the jobs banks, as long as they don't put it back in, next thing you know, they still sell to those companies when they get into a pinch. And they can't predict things like, for example, travel going up or down and the number of cars that the rental car companies are even going to want.
To John's point, I mean, they're cutting back on incentives, so they're trying to get to the point where they're not foisting off all their production on the market. They're not there yet. And residual building takes time, too. I mean, you know, these companies are still pretty, you know, early in the whole cycle of building brands and turning around at retail. And you're right. They're not there yet. But like with Malibu and some other cars, and Ford's residuals have done pretty well. Some of the domestics are starting to pop back, but they're still not where they need to be.
I was just, you know, shocked to see us up to the same exact games, in my opinion, that drove the industry off the cliff in the first place. I mean, as soon as Toyota started the incentive war and brought theirs up to about $2,900, right, you had $3,500, the average, you know, and there's better ways to do that than others. 0% financing is less damaging to residual values than a big bunch of money on the hood, right?
Chrysler fouled with 0%, right?
That was a good move. But, you know, they're selling too many cars to their fleets. And I don't think they care about that right now because they're conserving cash. And, you know, if the depreciation leaks over into the next generation of product, though, because the people that write the lease guides and the residual values, the ALG, and the insurers that come in and say that if you drop the car off, it's going to be worth X in 3 years, which is what the lease does. If all the shenanigans now to take, you know, fleets and rentals and all that stuff trickle over to the next generation of product, they're not going to be able to lease those either. You can't lease.
No, you're right, and I think that's one thing that may be hurting Malibu right now. Is the old Malibu was a pretty lousy car, and there was a lot of fleet and a lot of heavy discounting there, and it's taken them time to build a residual up with it. Because the new Malibu is light years better than the old one. Chrysler, I think, is going to have that problem with all the fleet and everything that's out there. It depresses used car pricing, which hurts the residual value. So even if the next you know, the Sebring Avenger replacements are really good, they're not going to be able to get the residuals and therefore the competitive lease deals and pricing immediately that they could based on how good the car may be. And that's if the car is really good. So it's a tough fight once you get in that incentive rebate fleet game and you hammer your brand image and residual values. It's you get on that downward spiral and it's tough to climb back out.
Well, that's why the other car companies, once Toyota started doing their scorched earth incentives, you know, to get back in the game, the other car companies were just like, oh no, this is not good.
And, not good at all, right?
And Mark, you made it real clear why it's not good. And, you know, I think consumers out there, oh yeah, it's a good deal, it's a great deal, but you pay down the road, and then everybody pays, the industry pays, and it's just perpetuating the cycle that brought this in, helped bring this industry down to its knees, and we can't go back on that track, or we'll be right back, you know.
Now, let's say inflation's going to run, okay? It's 2 or 3 years from now. It's going to run. Interest rates are going to have to run with it because nobody's going to lend any money if the rate isn't higher than the inflation rate. And we've had low inflation for a long time in this country. Now the money supply's pumped up to 300% of what it used to be from Fed bailouts and all the rest of the stuff that happened inside the industry and outside the industry. So this nature of asset-based lending, which, you know, the housing market, is the assets aren't worth what they were worth. So imagine that happening now in the auto sector. You know, as a car dealer, I want to clean up my local market. I want to clean up my local owner base to take the negative equity off the map. Because right now, KBB.com says that the average consumer is $4,700 upside down.
Wow.
So, and it's all from these activities.
How does that compare historically?
In 2005, it was $3,500.
So still high.
It's higher.
But it's growing.
Mm-hmm.
That's growing. If you look at the average cost of an automobile since the 1950s has grown with the average wages of the American worker at a steady clip. I mean, somewhere between 26 and 33 weeks is what it takes to pay for a car. And that's been the same for decades. So why does the term of finance now, you know, escalated to 64 months when the average consumer wants to trade his car in 39 months? It's to eat up this negative equity problem. Your payment either goes up or we extend your term or both. And in the meantime, we use whatever rebates are out there to cover up the mess and put you further upside down whenever you trade cars. So now imagine rolling in $4,700 worth of negative equity at 15 or 18% interest. Even you went out last time and bought a car at 0% interest. So really all you're worried about is the depreciation, and then it comes right back around and you don't have any buyers for the paper. So I advocate to dealers, you lease every car you can, because if you can't finance somebody that just has a fully paid-up contract and zero negative equity, and you can't get that person financed, then we should all go home. The store's not going to exist. But if you're relying on people coming back at 48 months that you've put in 72-month paper while the rest of this depreciation's going on, I think your local market's cooked, burnt, gone. And I'm sorry to say that, but I that's where we're at.
So what franchises do you have now?
Zero.
You're
out? I get out 45 days, by the grace of God, I get out 45 days before the domestics were lining up looking for bailouts.
You sold all your stores?
The last of them, yeah.
And you were able to sell them?
One of them I sold back to General Motors. They paid me in June or July, and that store definitely would have been under the knife if I waited any longer.
And you just got sick of it, or you saw the writing on the wall? I mean, how'd you time it that well?
Well, I saw the writing on the wall, plus I had stores stitched together with weird, innovative, you know, finance products. Like one note that consumes several properties. So if you had a hemorrhaging store, like the Chevrolet store was doing very, very well, and then gas and trucks hurt it, and it stopped doing well, I couldn't get rid of it without just tabula rasa, get rid of all of them. And I didn't want to do it at the time. I enjoyed the business. I had a Kia store still that was making a lot of money. I'd made a lot of money selling a Honda store. Sold my Pontiac Cadillac store, made money. So I guess I was winding down to having a store or two. And at the time, I said, you know, why is this happening to me? I don't really want to leave. But in retrospect...
Why did you make the decision to sell out?
The Chevrolet store had to go. But
why not keep the Kia store or the Honda store?
Because the mortgage was stitched together. It was bondholder-backed. It had huge yield maintenance penalties. And Citizens Bank, and this is in the book as well, had committed to me to buy the mortgage, split them, knowing that I was going to sell Chevrolet. But the commercial real estate market was turning down. The appraisals didn't line up. The bondholders all of a sudden decided that they wanted $1.2 million in penalties. So the only way to get out was to liquidate. And that's what I did.
Wow.
But as it turns out, it was the best thing that could have happened for me and my family. Because look at, you know, all the pain my friends have continued to go through. And
So are you ever going to get back in?
I don't think so. I really don't have an appetite for that. I'm passionate about understanding the business and helping other people with their problems. If it's either their choice to stay in or, you know, for some other reason they're holding on to it for a child, like I think my dad did, you know. He held on to that same store from the time I was 7, knowing that I was going to, you know, get it someday. And ironically, that was my demise. That's what forced me completely out of the business was that one store.
So you can sell to other dealers now?
Yeah, yeah. I like to help the kids in the business, you know, the sales consultants, because, you know, they're in a tough spot. They don't have any authority. You know, somebody comes in our age, and they usually don't have a lot of direction. They ask a lot of questions that their sales manager passes down to them, and the sales manager... they don't know how to really navigate. There's certain information they need to get you a car. Otherwise, they end up showing you a car for 2 hours, and you'll never get financing on it. But the manner in which they solicit that information can be very offensive to a customer. And that's why I use protagonists, Jack and Jill Hill, just trying to trade in their Mustang in the book, because I thought I could get it to a point where somebody would say, yeah, that's me. You know, that guy asked me that same question. Now, why did he ask me that question? And I explain in the book why he asked that question.
Well, you know, I'm sure we're going to have questions from our audience, too. So it's time to get to rapid fire. And, Ben, let's bring up the graphic. And that's Jason Vines, by the way, who I thought would be here tonight, but he told me he had a memorial to go to tonight for a guy that died. So we'll be getting him in the near future, but he is not going to be in here tonight. George wants to know, Mark Ragsdale, what do you feel about Ross Perot and what he was trying to do at GM?
You know, politics aside, because Ross, you know, kind of came off as being an on-the-edge kind of a guy, you know, big ideas and with a lot of boldness. And I respected that of him. And that's exactly the type of behavior that GM at the time and perhaps even today, they don't want to hear it.
I think you're right. Peter, I'm going to throw this one to you because I think this is right up your alley. It's from Artemis77. He says, what do you believe is the most successful auto ad campaign ever?
Well, I'm not going to say ever, but for a brand that hadn't existed before, wildly mediocre product, I thought Hal Reiney's campaign for Saturn, which was basically selling thin air to the American consumer and creating an aura for a product, again, that was very mediocre. Yeah, it had the body panels that would bounce back. I thought that was, I don't think it was the best, but it was certainly one of the most memorable and the most effective. But there are several, I mean, probably 20 great ad campaigns in the last 100 years.
What about the Saturn ad with the clown running down the street?
Well, that wasn't bad either.
What about Farfugnugan? I thought that would be in your...
You know, yeah, we can go down a list. I mean, yeah.
I think he said that sarcastically.
I didn't know what it meant.
I got that.
I happened to be driving a GTI today, which, as John and I were talking, is a fabulous car. And if there's anything that says joy, lives up to the joy campaign,
that is
the GTI is magnificent. But, yeah, there's been some horrible ones, too.
Okay, George from Brooklyn, this comes to you, Mark. How has the internet changed consumer buying habits?
Well, they can do a lot more research now. I could tell you 20 years ago when I went to dealer school, techniques like this. Somebody would call up and say, what's your best price on model XYZ? And you'd say, well, I'm not at my desk right now. Let me get your number. So it was about the sale was to get the contact information. Now, the consumer knows what you have in your lot better than you do, and he can shop you a lot more efficiently. And this got really cute. They would become an internet lead, and then they would show up in the showroom like they had never contacted anybody at the dealership to see if they could beat the best price that they had gotten from the internet. So it's an extremely empowering. There aren't going to be complete online transactions until leasing takes a huge chunk of the business, because the fight is always over the trade-in and the financing required to deal with that trade-in and being upside down.
David, I'm throwing this one to you. Mud Monster says, what are your thoughts of Chrysler leaving the European market and Lancia taking over?
Just Chrysler as a brand or as a company exiting Europe?
Well, I think he means the brand. I'm not even sure. Is that right? Is the Chrysler brand leaving Europe? Or they are going to merge Lancia and Chrysler brand together, right?
Not completely. They're merging the product lines. You know, Sergio said in January that they're sort of going to be kissing cousins or something like that. They're basically going to, you know, every car will be engineered the same, and they'll have some stylistic differences, but they're not going to merge them up as brands. I don't know. You know, Chrysler doesn't do much over there. They've sold a 300 and a 300 wagon that didn't sell over here in Europe, but such low volume. I think Chrysler's real play in Europe and definitely overseas is Jeep. That's, if you look at their plan, that's where the big growth is going to come from. So I don't see, you know, Chrysler doing a ton over there. I don't think they've got the marketing money and muscle to even really push it over there, especially if Jeep's going to be the big horse overseas.
What I also say that, you know, Lancia has never, ever done well, and I think they're hoping that putting some Chrysler products in the Lancia brand in Europe will help Lancia more than Lancia is going to help Chrysler.
Lancia has been, it's largely in Southern Europe, too. They don't really sell much in Northern, and their volume is,
it's mostly Italy.
Yeah, they don't sell much anywhere.
Right.
And they've got Alfa Romeo as an upscale, sporty brand. They got, you know, Jeeps are upscale and pricier vehicles. What do you need Chrysler over there for?
Yeah, Lancia might go the way of Plymouth, you know, if they're not careful.
It could. Hey, even Alfa loses money. So heads up.
Sergio's saying, oh, Alfa's going to do this, going to do that. It's just like, you got to relaunch that brand in the U.S. People don't know what Alfa is.
Right.
I wouldn't mind giving a Mito a test drive, though.
Well, sure. I mean, enthusiasts know what Alfa is, but
there's not enough to do it that
way. But selling 50, 60,000 Alfas in the U.S. within 3 years? You got to be kidding me. It's not going to happen. .com.
.org.
Jordan from Brooklyn wants to know, we'll go to you on this one, Mark. Why do manufacturers depend so heavily on fleet sales? Is it to dump excess capacity or amortize R&D costs?
I don't believe it's to amortize R&D costs. It is a production-driven issue. Your first loss is your best loss. They don't want them backing up on the ports. They don't want them backing up in the rail yards. The dealers are choking. They can't get rid of anymore. That's why I like the leasing model, because I know how many are going in and how many are coming out, and I can make secondary plans for those 30, 40,000 cars that are going to come out further down the road. When they build too many of them, sometimes fleets are the only outlet, and we all pay a heavy price when they...
But you can't ignore the fleet market. I mean, it's about 2 million vehicles a year. It's huge. And I'm talking 2 million vehicles.
And they have better content these days. And because the automakers have taken out a lot of capacity,
they're making some money on that fleet business now. It's not great business like a good retail sale, but they're making some money on it because they used to have stuff like three-month contracts. They'd take them back, and then they'd have to resell them and drive down values.
Right.
Now, you know, the last rental car I rented a few weeks ago had like 23,000 miles on it, and I've seen them over 30. So they're keeping the cars longer, and they're not dumping as much into the fleets. When fleet's done right, what it does is, so you have a plant that can make 200,000 cars a year, and if you've planned that right, then you're at retail pretty close to that or maybe even above it. And then if things get bad, if there's a recession or something, you can use some of the fleet business to kind of get you from 170 to 200 and keep the plant blowing and going. And you can kind of, you can use it even in certain quarters just to smooth out the peaks and valleys. But when you have a plant that can make 200,000 and you're only selling 120 at retail and you're dumping the rest in the fleet every month because no one wants the car, that's when it gets really troublesome and it results in what you've been talking about.
Well, here's what, in 06, Taurus was around 22, 22.5. So because consumers focus on dealer margin, that's what they are trained to do. That's what they're told to do by the industry and outside of the industry and at barbecues, you know, what kind of a price did you get? Well, so let's say the consumer in 2006 on a brand-new Ford dealership would negotiate down to $20,000 and buy his car, you know, high-fiving on the way out the door. I was buying those cars within 8, 9, 10 months for $10,000. The banks, because they're asset-based lenders, would finance $19,000 on those cars. So I could take somebody that was $7,000 upside down, make $2,000 for the dealership, and roll the car out the door, $9,000 upside down. And I did it. I did it. Okay? Not only that, some of them I blessed them with 84-month loans because you can't finance $19,000 for 36 months, and most households won't support that payment. So I did what everybody else did, which is stretch it out. Since all this nasty stuff has happened, you know, Ford can't afford to have their Tauruses losing. They're re-announcing the re-releasing the Taurus now, right?
Oh, already have.
Out, yeah.
Okay. So I don't think Ford wants a 60% hit on those cars. I don't think they want people in 84-month financing using a program car. I think the longer you can push out the fleet car, the older and higher mileage it can be, the less damage it does.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do with 84-month contract.
96 I've written.
Oh, my God.
That's unreal.
Huh? Well,
if it's not on
I'm
a
not
Bentley.
Short on the truth. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
You know? We believe
I'm
you.
I'm not an angel. I'm not an angel. I wasn't a clergyman. I wasn't their financial advisor. And I said I'm writing the book. I made deals with people that if I were on their side of the table, I wouldn't have made that deal. But now it's far more serious because, you know, we used to just be able to restrap them on because the credit market was such that, hey, somebody will loan them the money. And it's not going to be like, if it's like that, it kind of a little bit now, they're loosening up 2 to 3 years with the other things that are coming. You just can't do that. I can't make somebody 9,000 upside down on 15 or 18% APR financing.
Hey, we've got some phone calls here. And Ben, let's bring in the first that you can get your hands on there.
96 months.
Hi, John. This is Rick from San Diego. The new small Buick that will be introduced next year based on the Opel Astra seems to be having a lot of name problems. I was thinking what your thoughts were calling it the Insignia, Buick Insignia, instead of the Skylark or the Verona, I think it's supposed to be called. Just your thoughts. Thanks.
Well, we need Nina here.
Yeah.
From the naming.
Get the real name on that, right.
Yeah. Well, the Insignia is the Regal overseas, right?
The Opel version of the Buick Regal is the Opel Insignia.
Just to say you couldn't use it here is that, but it's still, you get people surfing the web and you get a disconnect. I'm not crazy about Verano. I'm not even sure if they're definitely going to use that. That's what's been out there, but they haven't officially told us that, but I'm not crazy about it either. I also don't like the old Buick names coming back because most of them weren't very good cars in the past 20 years. So
I don't know. I like Invicta.
Invicta is a good name.
I like Electra 225. Deuce, we need a deuce and a quarter back.
Actually, there's one Buick name that could come back and be, if the car was cool and sporty. I like Riata as a name, and I liked the car.
And Riviera, I think.
Oh, well, they need to do a drop-dead gorgeous.
Yeah, but not for a compact, obviously.
No.
It's got to be a real rib.
I'm not so sure the compact is the way to go for Buick either.
I hear you, but I don't think any automaker can avoid it these days.
No, they can't, but...
I mean, you even see the luxury guys, you know, BMW, Audi, yeah. Mercedes, oh, yeah. all no, coming out.
Buick can pull off a compact, but it's got to be...
I'd rather see a new Riviera than a compact.
I agree, totally. I think it would be better for Buick.
I want to see a Super 8. I want to see the G8 turn into a Super 8.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call there.
Hey, everybody. It's Nathan Keeley from Zanesville, Ohio. I just had one question. Okay, the Honda Civic looks like an egg, and the Toyota Corolla is a big hunk of bland, so why so hard on the Chevy Cruze?
Why so hard on the Chevy Cruze? You got a chance to drive around in a Chevy Cruze this week, David.
I didn't get to drive, but I got to ride.
Right.
The car actually does look better in person than it does in pictures, but it's not as aggressively styled.
It's boring. It's a very dull, boring exterior styling.
Especially when you put it up next to the Focus.
Right.
What I think the issue with Cruze will be, it's not an exciting style. It's going to pale, definitely in comparison to the Focus. This is where GM's going to have to do it right with marketing, because the interior of the Cruze is fantastic, and because it's not as aggressively styled as the Focus, it has more interior space, and I think it's got more interior legroom. It's a more comfy car. That dashboard it's like the current Cadillacs. I mean, it's got the big gauges coming out, and it's got the same kind of V-shaped center stack. It's a great interior.
I would expect it to drive very well as well.
It's a very comfortable car. Not a lot of rotor wind noise. It's really quiet. I was impressed with the ride and the craftsmanship and everything. The styling's not going to turn heads and draw people to the showroom, so, you know, Joe Iwanek's going to have to find a way to get people to get in this thing. If they can get people to sit in the car and drive it, they could have a hit. But it's going to be tough with... The styling's just not a selling point. You know, it is pretty boring. They're going to have to find another way to get people into the showrooms.
Okay, Mark, this one's for you. It comes in from Jim. He says, does your guest know the Buick man, and what do you think of him? Don't know him?
I don't know the Buick man.
The Buick man is a guy, Jim Dollinger is his name, who sells more Buicks than anybody has ever sold Buicks. So
I never crossed paths with him.
Okay.
No. Where is he?
He's up in Flint, Michigan. Or that area.
God bless him. Good for him. I'm gonna Google him tomorrow. I'll be on his site.
Crayon Blanc, actually.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's see. What does the panel think of Saab's plan to survive on less than 100,000 sales a year? And I have to say, anybody who wants to know a lot about Saab, tune into Autoline Detroit this weekend, because we just taped a show yesterday with Victor Mueller, the guy who bought Saab. And pretty interesting case that he puts forward as to how he's going to turn Saab around.
They just announced a $399 a month lease on the 9-3 with, you know, $3,500 startup costs. But they're going to try to make a go of it. I don't know what to say about
it. As people will see on Autoline this Sunday, Victor Mueller is a powder keg of a personality, and he's passionate about cars, passionate about racing, loves the Saab brand. I mean, the energy is there. My question is the cash flow is the cash flow there to build the new models that he wants to bring out? Are they going to have enough to market these things? Will they have enough money to market this brand and convince people that the brand isn't dead?
Yeah.
A lot of people think the brand died in all of this.
Right.
You know, all that's gone on in the past year with General Motors. So he's got a big, big fight ahead of him. It's a pretty cool niche brand, but I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the guy made an almost impossible deal happen. GM wanted to liquidate it through sheer force of will. So he may, you know, maybe he's got the will to pull this thing off.
We'll see if he does.
By the way, they do have cool products coming. The design of the new 9.5 is dynamite.
Dynamite.
And that's the same styling theme that you see on the 9.4X and I think the 9.3 too as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
well, they haven't tipped their hand on the next 9.3.
But I've heard from inside GM that it's a similar theme.
9.5 has real, real good road presence, though, when you see it in the flesh.
I think it's a hot car.
Yeah.
My son, who's a car aficionado, 12 years old, I mean, he knows every little nuance of everything, parts, I mean, just arcane stuff. He wanted to see a Koenigsegg Saab. you know, because he likes that $1.3 million look.
Yeah.
Good taste. That might take even more than 96% financing, at least.
Yeah, yeah. Right, the spiker cars.
Well, they'll bring a Saab Sonnet. Maybe they'll do a...
Well, what do you, Victor showed us this. He wouldn't let us show it on the show. But,
92.
David, you saw it, too. A modern-day version of the Teardrop 92. And it's... boy, they build that, and they are going to catch some attention.
It's like a mini A1, you know, Audi A1 fighter.
But with that shape.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
it was really cool.
Because that original Saab was very cool.
No doubt about it. And it was all aircraft engineers. That's why. Because it wasn't car guys. It was guys who had been building airplanes that said, okay, let's take the wings off and put some wheels on.
They really style those cars right.
I'm telling you, the design winners will win. The best designers will win for these companies.
The problem is it just takes so much money to keep a car company going and come up with new products and technology and engines. They don't have their own engines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that it's no longer born from jets?
Well, that was just, it no longer is. It no longer, you know what most people don't know is.
The ad line.
I was fishing for Peter.
Yeah.
I mean, bobber with the worm.
That would be a 24-hour show.
Yeah. If we that start, was like the Farfugnugan.
Yeah, if we start going over bad car campaigns, we need a lot more alcohol.
We should have a show where we talk about the best and worst car campaigns and the best and worst rock and roll, auto rock and roll tunes.
Okay, well, we could, but that can't be an hour.
Not tonight.
No.
We'll plan that one out. But we got another phone call, too. Let's bring in that last one that we've got there, Ben.
Hi, this is Jonathan Brown from Old Japan, New Jersey. I just have a quick question. Was Kirk Kerkorian and Jerry York, if I got the names right, were they right in saying that, you know, a year or two ago, GM, or 3 years ago, whatever it was, GM should sell off Saab and Hummer and just have Chevrolet and Cadillac? Seems like those crazy guys at the time might have actually had a crystal ball. So what's your opinion on that? Thank you very much.
Oh, well, it was Jerry's plan. Jerry York, who died last month, he was right on with just about everything he wanted GM to do. He wanted them to sell off Hummer and Saab. He wanted them to, I think, sell off Allison Transmission as well and keep GMAC, sell the mortgage business.
Mm.
He wanted them to cut the dividend long before they cut the dividend, stop giving money away to shareholders when they couldn't pay their debt. And, you know, basically what he wanted to do is a lot of what Alan Mulally's done at Ford. Sell off the non-core stuff, get down to what you need, your core brands, your finance business, get rid of the other junk, and spend executive time and all your capital on that which makes your money. And it was just keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah, Jerry was on the right track, but Jerry was never going to go anywhere within the GM system.
No.
It just wasn't going to happen.
No, Jerry
But if
wasn't.
I had the money, I would have bought Hummer. I believe in Hummer. I think... I believe in the small Hummer, the H4, and if you had the money, that Hummer brand could have survived in this country.
But as a really niche brand.
Well, thrived as a niche
brand. But I wouldn't have just concentrated in this country, because I think if you took that thing globally, I agree with you, Peter, I think it had a lot of legs to it.
Well, globally, the Hummer image is fantastic. And I would have suffered the slings and arrows here to keep the global thing going, because once you had the money to bring that H4X, I don't care what Wrangler Chrysler came up with, you could blow that Wrangler out of the water if you did
it
right.
It could have survived as more of a recreational fun car or fun SUV brand, sort of almost like the Lamborghini of SUVs, you know, all about off-road. Because that H4 or HX shouldn't have been it. They wanted to make it a cheap Hummer that was accessible. No, you make it the coolest off-roading, riding on sand dunes at 60
miles. Well, they had, you know, they had turbo diesel drivetrains ready to go. I mean, that thing was going to get over 30 on the highway, and it was just, well, whatever.
But you had to go for price and make them premium cars that people who love SUVs want to drive. You can't go for volume with that brand, because you'll never get it.
No, you can't.
In China, you'd get it.
Yeah, but I'm talking about for this market.
Oh, for here?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that the caller mentioned was GMAC. Here's something else that drove dealers batty. GMAC would charge between 7.5% and 8.5% for floor plan, for dealer inventory carrying costs.
Was this after GM sold half of it?
No.
Before?
This is when they were writing 30-year mortgages at 5.25%.
Wow.
So the dealers are paying 3 points higher. And, you know, looking back, it had something to do with GMAC being able to go out and securitize those mortgages, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they were flipped and sold God knows how many times and ended up tossed up in some toxic salad someplace with derivatives hanging out the side and everything, right? But that was what they were focused on. But supporting the dealers, and this is why I get concerned about asset-based lending or not in the car industry, they were charging them 2 and 3 points higher. So, but from a dealer standpoint, you know, they felt as though you were taking care of a stranger and mortgaging the house better than you were taking care of me as a dealer that has $1 million tied up in the facility and, you know, my house is also on the line. I'm personally guaranteeing everything.
So could the dealers have gotten lower-cost financing from a bank or another lender for the floor plan?
Yes, I did. You could. You could get, you know, close to prime or somewhere
really?
Floating around
so
you know, 400 basis points. Pressure. I mean, you know, when I got away from GMAC, my phone rang off the hook. You know, it's only going to cost you $6,000 more a month to stay with us, was the attitude. I had a branch manager say that to me. When I built my Honda store, they wouldn't touch the project. You know, another bank took the project. But they wrote millions and millions of dollars in home mortgages that all tipped upside
billions.
Down.
Yeah.
You know, the I haven't researched the numbers, but I can tell you that is what put that arm down. It wasn't anything that the dealers did.
Oh, ResCap, which was the mortgage business, lost $17 billion from 2007 to 2009.
Well, when GM gave up their ability to finance, that was probably the single biggest mistake of the modern era that corporation
made. You look at what a lot of what GM did over this past decade. All of it was burning the furniture to keep the house warm till tomorrow. The massive rebates and incentive binge, which destroyed residual values and made it tougher for them to sell cars and make money tomorrow to keep the factories running today and pay the union obligations today. Selling 51% of GMAC, losing control of your lender to get cash to stay out of bankruptcy today, but it hurts your ability to do leasing and make loans tomorrow. And that was the mentality, was just survive. And there was no plan to get out of that. That downward spiral was sort of, well, hopefully the economy will turn someday or the products, tomorrow's products will make us so much money that all of this, we'll be able to buy back control of GMAC and we'll, you know, the cars will be so good that the residuals will be better and all of this stuff will just sort of heal itself because what we're doing now is going to be executed well. It was a big pipe dream.
You see, the focus is always on the wrong thing. And it doesn't matter what player outside of dealer world, whether it's a consumer group or the government. This new consumer products, finance products agency, if consumers think that the shopping experience bites now, wait until after the government gets involved. If dealers don't get exempted from this, it's going to at least double the amount of time that consumers need to be in car dealerships because dealers are going to have no blessed idea of gathering the information necessary to put them and demonstrate the right car for them financially. Dealers didn't cause the housing crisis. Dealers are capped by the banks on how much commission they make. If not, they're capped by the state. They sign the contract and send it all off to the bank and wait for a check.
One thing about dealers, though, because I've been covering this business for about 14 years, and dealers are always complaining to me about how much money they make in this sort of thing. And then, you know, there was a dealer down in Dallas that I knew who always used to go, oh, GM cut my gross. They did this, they did that. And then one day he sends me an email with him on a salmon boat. I said, where are you? He said, every year I rent 2 salmon boats and bring out about 50 of my friends. And a lot of these guys make a lot of money, and they complain all the time. Where's the
Average store makes $500,000 a year. That's the average. You can get it right from NADA. Now, there are anomalies. There's, you know, Metro Lexus stores that make $2 million a month. But for every one of those, there's 25 other guys that don't even make $500,000 a year. So it's a volume-driven business. During boom times, at low grosses, going for the volume, they have a good lifestyle. When things turn down like they do now, they often give it all back. So instead of the salmon, you know.
I don't know how much time we have here, but one thing you haven't talked about is how much is left out of that gross for the salesman on the floor. There's an ex-dealer I know who did a study for GM about 5 years ago that showed that in Dallas-Fort Worth, GM dealers were paying their salesperson $50 and $75 commissions per sale, or, you know, $100 for selling something like a Suburban, which had a big gross on it. So they couldn't keep people in the stores, salespeople, with any experience because they weren't making any money. They'd quit and go elsewhere. Anyone who actually did it and was good would go to another brand because they knew how to sell and they could get a bigger commission and make more money. And those who were sort of making ends meet check to check, fairly hanging on, were just demoralized. I mean, how hard are you going to work to sell a car if you're going to make $50?
Well, it's an odd business. It's a bookend to bookend. You're there. I didn't see my father a lot when I was a kid. My father was always at the store. And the early part of my career, I was always at the store selling cars. That said, the salesperson makes, including, you know, some cars are flats or minis. Usually that $75 or $100 is a minimum commission because the gross gets beat down so far in a competitive market that the salesman's got to get something. So even if there is a salary as a component of their pay plan, the commissions are $350 to $400 per car, all in. So if you take the national average of 9 to 10 cars a month for a salesperson, he's working 60, 70 hours a week to make $50,000. And usually the factory comes in behind it and puts on some special incentives that they can vie for. You know, they like to, you know, have them chase a trip or a Rolex or some cash programs. But it's a tough row to hoe for these guys. I mean, the average gross profit's $1,200. And my wife says, well, that sounds like a lot of money to people. I said, well, you know, it's less of a margin than the grocery stores make. You know, they make more of a margin on a can of peas than the dealer does. There's something fundamentally wrong with that. The market's completely upside down. All right? Everybody owes more in their car than what it's worth. And the dealers, you know, have to compete with those kind of margins. You know?
Well, we're not going to solve it tonight.
Hey, Jeff,
but, yeah.
We got a phone call from Mark.
Okay, let's take this phone call, and we'll be wrapping it up after that. Ben, go ahead. Let's bring it in.
Hi, this is Mike from Troy. John, please ask your guest what effect the CAFE, Corporate Average Fuel Economy Standards, have on selling vehicles. From a consumer point of view, it has a different look and feel, I'm sure, as it does from his point of view. Sometimes the automakers will incentivize a car just to meet the CAFE requirements, and the consumer isn't aware of that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Any thoughts on that, how car makers have got to meet fuel economy standards and how that...
I completely disagree with the... It's just poor timing. You know, stop it. Even the most conservative estimates on what's required to hit those standards is $1,500. That's the most conservative. Most people say it's $3,500. So let me do the math. Let's pick the middle. Let's say it's $2,500 to hit the standards, $4,700 upside down. And then we're going to take 60 months of financing, and that's going to cost us $18 per month per thousand. You know, I don't think people have that kind of money kicking around right now to hit that. And so from that standpoint, plus the fact that it was done through regulation instead of legislation, I think is another issue. And then it's so complex that it's not the same for everybody. If an automaker had sold fuel-efficient cars previously, they got hit harder than somebody that sold mostly trucks previously. And maybe you can answer this. Did Chrysler separate Dodge and Dodge trucks? Did that have any impact on the new CAFE standards coming up?
No.
No.
No?
No, it wouldn't.
No.
Because they don't do it by brand.
Same
they do
corp?
It by, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think CAFE is ludicrous, but that's another
one. Yeah, that's another one. We're not going to solve that one
drum.
Tonight either.
Yeah, right? We've all agreed that, CAFE is just a really terrible way to try to cut fuel use.
It's the slowest, least effective, most expensive way to try to get us off.
Most compromised way and most complicated,
right.
Confusing way. It's just
and
ridiculous.
It probably will not work.
We get 248 million cars on the road today. By the way, we have 38 million more cars than we do driver's licenses, right? And we're going to fix that selling 10.5 million cars a year with a 62% scrap rate. It takes two decades, and by that time, technology is going to evolve anyway.
Right.
The combustion motor will, well, I hope not, but it'll probably mostly be gone.
Very possibly. But, hey, we ought to wrap this up. Mark, thanks so much for coming in today. Very interesting. I love getting a dealer's perspective of the whole industry. And, David, great having you here as always.
And pleasure, John.
Peter, always great having you in the house.
Glad to be here, John.
And I want to remind everybody you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit or twitter.com/AutoLine. You can always read Peter's column at autoextremist.com. Or follow him at twitter.com/autoextremist. Go to businessweek.com, and you can always find David's stuff there. Still have your cover story on Ed Whitaker up there, right?
You can find it, sure.
Yeah. And then, let's see, for Mark here, it's what?
MarkRagsdale.com.
MarkRagsdale.com.
And
the book, I understand you can't get it. It's sold out right now. I hear you cannot buy this on Amazon. You can see that they sell it, but they say there are no books in stock right now.
Well, it's been number one in buying and leasing now for weeks, and it floats in and out of the top 100 on finance, which I think Amazon has about 600,000 titles. So they, you know, there's been spikes, and they occasionally run out of books, but they'll get them to you. But I like people to come to my website, come to markragsdale.com. All my social media links there. We can hook up. We can chat. You can get a lot of tips and information there, and you understand from excerpts where I stand on things. And I appreciate your endorsement of the book, by the way. I'm sure some people will read it because you said you liked it.
Absolutely. No, I found a number of very good tidbits of information in there.
I should do something with Peter on the United States of Toyota, like a co thing. So, you know.
Yeah, I'm working on my next book now, so.
When's that out, you know?
I don't know. I have to see. The working title is America Needs an Enema. Thank you very much. Try the roast beef. It's excellent.
Is this thing on?
That's great.
Take my wife, please.
Right. And thank all of you for having tuned in. Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.